The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. No plan B, two strikes and you're out, batter a burglar, shop a shirker, sink or swim. Is this the moment that David Cameron's Tories took a decisive right turn? And do voters really want tabloid Toryism? Meanwhile, broadsheet Boris brings the house down with his joke-filled address. And with the SNP due to meet for their annual conference next week, could we see 16-year-olds getting the vote in the independence referendum? Will we care and will they? Joining me for all of this, we've got the Guardian columnist Martin Kettle, the political commentator Gabby Hinsliff, and the Boris biographer and political journalist Andrew Jimson. A warm welcome to you all. Well, the Conservative Party has been meeting this week for its annual conference in Birmingham, and our own Michael White has been there every step of the way.
Let us here in this hall, here in this government, together in this country, make this pledge. Let us build an aspiration nation. Let us get Britain on the rise. Deficit paid down, tough decisions taken, growth fired up, aspiration backed all the way. We know what it takes to win in the tough world of today, to win for all our people, to win for Britain. So let us get out there and do it.
David Cameron's just taking the applause of the crowd walking through them with his wife Samantha. He gave her the obligatory kiss like they all have to nowadays, awkward moment. Let's go outside and see what the paying customers thought of it all.
I thought it was excellent.
What
really
do you like about it?
I think he's really shown that we are the party for the whole nation and not what Ed Miliband claims that his party is.
So it's quite a sort of reassuring speech. Okay, thank you.
I think it was amazing. I think it's the fact that Mr Cameron's getting there and he's doing what the people want at the end of the day. He's putting Britain back on the map.
Here's a couple of delegates, Matthew Paris and Danny Finkelstone. What do we think, chaps? A couple of seasoned pros from the Times.
It exceeded my expectations. He's often a bit languid. I found it had a surprising intensity about it, and they liked it more than they thought they were going to.
It was more moderate and emollient in tone than I might have expected, Danny.
The problem is when you listen to someone say for 45 minutes what you already agree with, you have a temptation to believe that you're hearing Winston Churchill. So I have to leave it to a certain extent to other people to judge, because I realise, as I say, that I'm sort of clapping things that I already thought beforehand. However, I did think it was well delivered. I thought he made the arguments for certain Conservative things well. If you had a criticism, it started with an argument about the economy and it didn't really have a strong economic section. So I think that was a bit of an omission. However, overall, what he was trying to do obviously was contrast himself as Prime Minister making tough decisions with Ed Miliband as opposition leader not doing so. I thought it was effective in that way.
Matthew, the point about the economy is not a lot he can say about the economy except to say it's much worse than we thought, it's going to be awful, and he's right.
Yes, I think it was quite enough about the economy. And myself, I wasn't expecting to like the personal stuff about his father and everything, but I thought that was absolutely fine.
Yeah, he turned it with a good joke about the glass half full.
Yes, in ideological terms, the speech was plonked slap in the centre, neither to the left nor the right. I'm a little bit relieved by that.
Here's a cross-section of society. What can you tell the
guy?
Hello. What did you think of the speech?
These people that are on benefits, I'm a widow, a pensioner, and I do a few hours of medication nurse, and that's what I cannot stand, these yobs walking about, in the streets, drinking, smoking, and couldn't care less.
Okay, let's ask your friends very quickly, what do you all like about the speech?
What I'm really impressed with is that Cameron fairly quietly has looked past Europe for trade and business and industrial growth.
And you, sir?
He's the right man for the Times, and he's prepared to say that it's the Labour Party that stands against the aspirations of children achieving what they can. And I think he was really, really direct on that. And it's
an education point that about free schools and independent academies and things and raise the bar for kids.
Absolutely. And there is a proper education revolution going on, and it's not before time.
None of you have mentioned, and I haven't mentioned, the B for Boris word. I thought it was a much more substantial speech than Boris's, but of course, less humour and less jokes. Yes?
I think Boris is a good mayor and David Cameron's a good Prime Minister, and that's where they should stay. I don't think there's any doubt about that. As you say, Boris Johnson knows what he's doing in London. David Cameron knows what he's doing with the UK. And his whole speech, so that, especially the education, as Andrew mentioned, and that is the vital part, I think, starting from the bottom, making sure children get a fair and decent education.
Well, it was Boris's day, of course, earlier in the week, and I watched Boris's speech from the cafeteria, where people weren't initially listening. They were on their mobile phones and reading their papers, gradually got drawn into Boris.
When the economy has turned around, and we're already seeing signs of progress, when people are benefiting from jobs and growth and the firm leadership you have shown, the tough decisions you have taken, not least coming on to hear this speech today. So many, happy birthday, by the way. Happy birthday, by the way. And I was pleased to see that you've called me a blonde-haired mop in the pages of the... a mop is what I am. Well, if I'm a mop, Dave, then you are a broom. A broom that is cleaning up the mess left by the Labour government, and a fantastic job you are doing. And I thank you, and I congratulate you, and your colleagues, George Osborne, the dustpan, Michael Gove, the J-cloth, William Hague, the sponge, because it is the historic function of Conservative governments over the last 100 years to be the household implements, so effective on the floor of the House to clear things up after the Labour binge has got out of control. And it is thanks to...
What struck me listening to his speech was that you could take the word London out and put Britain in, and what you were listening to was a Prime Minister's speech.
Thank you very much. That's interesting. And you don't have to. It's not compulsory. Not yet it's not compulsory. What did you think?
Well, I thought it was an excellent speech by Boris, and very supportive of the government and the government's message. And
sure about that, aren't you?
I'm quite sure. He's very supportive of David Cameron and George Osborne and the need to take tough action. Spoke out strongly against the two Eds and their bankrupt economic policy. I think people are very pleased with that.
Is it not his fault that he constantly upstages them? It just happens. Just bad luck.
I don't think he upstages anybody. I think he's an important compliment. He does have a very big electoral mandate. He's a very prominent member of the Conservative Party. We're very proud to have him here.
And, of course, he caricatures himself, Boris, but he has great lines, many of which I think he makes up as he goes along. We've not only fulfilled our promises, we've fulfilled Labour's promises. And then those long strings of Chateau Neuf du Pape, bendy bus, all that balls. And, you know, he's like a professional comedian. People are primed to laugh at whatever he says. That's a great talent. Professional comics work for years, so just get people to think it's funny before they say it. Boris could read the London phone book and get away with it.
Our very own Michael White there. Martin Kettle, the week that was in Birmingham, very much about Dave versus Boris. We'll come on to that in a moment, but the other speeches people may have missed. Do you think this was white van conservatism reasserting itself?
Well, I think the conference wanted to have something it could give to the papers every morning. It was concerned very much to dominate the headlines. There was a battle going on, basically. They didn't want Boris, and they didn't want the anger that there is in some parts of the party and the disaffection towards David Cameron to surface at all. So each day there was something on offer from George Osborne, from Chris Grayling, Theresa May, and so forth. And they dealt with they absorbed Boris within that. And I bumped into somebody from Number 10 after 2 days and said, how do you think it's going? And he said, well, the grid's won 2 and the press have lost 2. So I think that was how they saw it.
Triumph in those terms. Gabby, did you think it was a rightward move before we got to David Cameron's speech?
I think it's always, you have to remember that Conservative Party Conference is the party at its Toryist. You know, it is absolutely about preaching to the converted, and it's the most right-wing moment of the year. You don't go to conference with a wussy liberal speech, you go with a tub-thumping one. And I think what I was struck by was how little new thinking there was, actually. I mean, Basha Bergler, blimey, that's been with us for about 10 years, and it makes sort of annual appearance at party conference. I bumped into William Hague's old spin doctor from 9 years ago at conference. He was like, I remember briefing Basher Birdler. I said, I remember you briefing it to me. If that's the best you can come up with, this is not new stuff. So I think what he was doing was trying to position the party not so much further to the right as further towards the squeezed middle. It was much more pitching at sort of working class, blue collar Tories, precisely the kind of Tories who have drifted away since 2010. And I think it was much more about that than a rightward shift.
Andrew, do you think there was a mood shift this week?
I think there definitely was an appeal to Essex Man on the welfare stuff, backing the strivers against the people who have their blinds drawn sort of at lunchtime. And also this sort of, you can shoot any vaguely suspicious person hanging around outside your house and then you realise afterwards it's the postman or something. So I think it all seemed a little bit, I mean, I have no information that Linton Crosby is necessarily going to sweep in and take over, but it all seemed a bit Linton Crosby-ish. As Martin said, they were very anxious to sort of suppress Boris, but they did it at a cost, I think, of having the usual highly professional but terribly sterile event. And, of course, people thrilled to Boris because he isn't sterile and you never quite know what he's going to do.
And then, all right, Andrew, on the big moment when it arrived, I mean, the thing that struck me about Boris's speech in the hall, which I was there sort of penned in between activists for, was that it was optimistic in a very, very pessimistic week otherwise.
Yes, he is the man who says we can win. I mean, when he says that to Cameron, to Dave, as he very respectfully calls him, he adopts the tone of a sort of schoolmaster who thinks that if this pupil sort of does another 2 years very hard work, then this rather dim character called Dave might conceivably scrape a sort of C pass in some obscure GCSE subject. So it was highly patronising towards the Prime Minister, but of course it cheered the party up because he has, not only does he say we can win, he has just won.
Do you think he got as much out of it as he was hoping to? I mean, obviously the bounce was there huge in the polls before going into Birmingham.
Hanging over Boris is the terrible example of his predecessor in Henley, Michael Heseltine, assassinated Margaret Thatcher, and of course the party has never forgiven Heseltine. Now, it's true that David Cameron is not as beloved a figure as there isn't a sort of loyal sort of Tory group of sort of SS men who want to keep Cameron in for forever and ever. But Boris doesn't want to actually overplay his hand, precipitate a contest now, which anyone could win. We might end up with sort of Philip Hammond or someone. So it would be madness for him to overdo it. He's not even in Parliament, and even he would find it quite difficult to have going to be elected in May to say, right, I'm off. the call is higher office beckons, so I'm off to Downing Street. So he needs to play a slightly longer game than that. His game at the moment, obviously, is to establish himself as the man to whom they will turn if and when the Cameroons are seen to have failed.
When it was Dave's turn in the spotlight, as we can disrespectfully call him too, Martin, I guess, you know, there was a conscious effort, wasn't there, to look like here was the serious player. You know, you've had your showman, and now here's the serious, real.
I mean, that's true. I mean, the contrast between, you know, somebody who's basically an anti-politician and someone who is a politician to his fingertips was absolutely clear as anything there. I mean, Cameron gave a speech which was technically competent, I thought, and actually put out quite an interesting argument, because I think, in a tactical sense, he's trying to lower expectations because things are going worse than expected, and he is basically trying to say, when the general election comes, you've got to stick with Nurse for fear of something worse in the shape of Ed Balls and Ed Miliband. And so he's basically trying to push Labour into a position where it looks reckless and could be sold as the kind of throw-it-all-away party by the Tories. Whether that's going to work or not, it's too early to say. But, I mean, that was the kind of tactical positioning he was doing. I thought as a speech, I think it was probably, you know, adequate. He was never going to out-glitter Boris, and he didn't try. And I think its weakness was essentially that, you know, it was talking about things in on a fairly kind of abstract and generalized level about aspiration and so on. That's fine. We're all in favor of aspiration. We're all, and in all circumstances, it's a safe position to take. But I mean, there was nothing very concrete in the speech, and the basic notion, you know, that Britain can rise in some kind of levitating way in a world which is in a very interconnected world, where basically the economy is shot in our part of the world and there are all kinds of problems which are long-term problems and structural. The basic idea that you can kind of whistle and it will be better is not really very convincing.
So, Gabby, it fails the kettle test if it's deconstructed as a piece of State of the Nation address sort of thing. But in terms of having a few clap lines and hitting Labour where it hurts as not being trusted with public money, do you think he did a good job?
Yeah, so it was road testing what's going to be the election strategy, obviously. And it was a serious grown up sort of speech. It was joined up thinking. It was the first sort of really successful attempt I've seen from him to kind of explain why he's both a modern, why it's possible to be both a moderniser and true to old Tory values. You know, work hard, do right by your family, all the rest of it. The weakness for me was absolutely no reason to have any ideas anymore. It's all about political positioning and not at all about policy. And it's all very well sort of put yourself in the right place, but then you need to have ideas and concrete things to explain how we're going to get in the direction you're going. At the moment, all we know is that, you know, Britain will rise in some magical fashion, but we're not in any sense clear how. We're also, actually, with a speech, for it was a speech about rising, it's been a conference as much about falling. Mm. The sense of all the policies is, you know, your life's a bit rubbish, but instead of making things better for you, we're going to make it worse for other people and see if that cheers you up. So, you know, so if you can't afford to have another child, well, we can't do anything about that, but we'll make sure that poor people can't have children either. And if you can't afford to buy a house, we'll make sure that under 25s on housing benefit have to go back and live with their parents too. So we can't, you know, necessarily bring you up, but we can make other people fall that bit further.
God, that's a grim reading.
Because that's what we're all really looking for, other people to do badly. That's my definition of success.
I mean, that's a fairly grudging appraisal. And I mean, I suppose it is odd, isn't it, Andrew, that this whole kind of tone of somberness and we stood together in the Blitz and times were bad then, and by Jove, we'll come through. And then to just say at the end, and Britain will rise. Do you find that convincing?
No, I'm going to be grudging too. I mean, from a more Tory perspective, I still don't think Cameron connects with the British people. He hit Labour quite hard and sort of repelled the One Nation attack, which Miliband had made. But I don't
One think Notion, that was a good
one
joke.
One Notion, that was a good line. But as a man of Tory disposition, I was, for example, I was absolutely horrified by a line when he said, line one, rule one of being a Conservative is that it's not where you've come from that counts, it's where you're going. This is utter nonsense. I mean, for Conservatives, tradition, where you come from, is absolutely essential. It absolutely determines, in fact, where you can get to and what you now need to do. And I think it suggested, although he had that line about how he went to a great school, it suggested that he's essentially still very worried about his background. And that is bad because it makes him sound bogus and evasive, actually. So as a Tory, I just don't think, I think he's got a lot, I think the Tory party are very, very unhappy with Cameron. They didn't, no one sort of came out and spoiled the conference by saying so. Why should they? No point. But a lot of MPs are fantastic. They just think Cameron is incredibly rude to them, completely ignores them. I mean, backbenchers, admittedly, inclined to say this about whoever is party leader, but a lot of them don't even really think that Cameron is a decent Tory, and they think that he's just sort of in bed with Nick Clegg.
Well, this is very interesting. I mean, Ian Duncan Smith's Quiet Man speech got cheered to the rafters. I have to say, I think it was a much worse
completely
speech.
Completely stage-managed cheers, yes.
I was going to say, yeah, they always get cheered to the rafters. That doesn't mean a huge amount. People work very quick to...
So the fact he got through, you're both saying, doesn't give him any security. I mean, do you think are we talking about possibly a challenge, Andrew, before the general election? Is the mood that bad or not?
I'd be surprised if there's a challenge because it would be so obviously self-destructive. On the other hand, the Tories have destroyed quite a number of leaders in their time. It really depends obviously on how the economy goes, how the polls go, and whether Cameron manages now to run a reasonably efficient thing. But Cameron likes to control everything. That's why he's got this horrible, another affront to the British Constitution, this fixed-term Parliaments Act. And people fret under that kind of attempt to control them. So I think it's still quite a, although he's a highly professional figure, I have a lot of respect for his technical abilities. I think he's still in quite a dangerous position.
Martin?
Well, I think that's right. And I think that we should remember that before the conference season, I think there was really quite a lot of concern, and a great deal of it in the Tory high command, about how this conference season would go. I think both the Liberal Democrats and the Tories, you know, were concerned that there would be leadership challenges of a pretty effective and uncontrollable kind during their weeks in conference. Now, neither of those things has happened, but that doesn't mean that those feelings have gone away. I think that's really one of the things Andrew had just been saying. And I mean, it seems to me that both the problems of the Lib Dems and the Tories pretty obviously stem from the coalition's lack of success. So the number one thing that this government needs and that these parties need is something that they can turn around and present to the electorate as a copper-bottomed success in economic terms, and that's not there at the moment. But the other thing that I think has to happen in the Tory party is, you know, Cameron's really got to find a way in which he can get his party to rally behind him and to recognise that he is, in fact, their best asset in many respects. I mean, he is the bit of the Tory party that the electorate still has time for. If you look at the polling, I mean, the Tory party is doing extremely badly vis-a-vis Labour, and the only bit where there's encouragement for them is in Cameron's ratings vis-a-vis Ed Miliband, and they are narrowing, as we've just been saying. So, I mean, he's got to find a way of asserting his leadership, and they've got to find a way of learning to love him.
Andrew, can you just come back on that? Because you said you thought that he doesn't connect with the British public, but Martin talks about these opinion poll figures that show that he's still just preferred to Ed Miliband as best Prime Minister.
Just, but it's fragile, and I think that's one reason why Cameron is so tentative. I mean, admittedly, they did win, 96 extra seats last time, but they only put on, I think, 3.7% percentage points. It was a very weak performance in what should have been an extremely good year for the Tories. So, unless he convinces his own troops that they're going to win in 2015 or that they've got a good chance of that, then there will be a lot of grumbling. And, of course, some of it will be from sort of outspoken sort of mavericks like Nadine Dorries. But actually, I've spoken to quite sort of solid mainstream Tories, some of them from the 2010 intake, and they also, which is a gifted intake, and a lot of them are pretty fed up with Cameron too. And the terrible sort of, I mean, the sort of bomb which is waiting to explode, which everyone tiptoed around, I mean, every party tiptoed around, is Europe. And there's an election, there's a lot happening in Europe, and there are European elections in 2015, and there's a party called 14, thank you, sir. Professor Kettle corrects me. He's always much more in command of these things than I am. But there's UKIP, which is, you know, it's the lost Tory tribe, and no sign yet that Cameron has any idea what to do about that.
Interesting. And Gabby, so they've got that European problem that's been there for a generation, flaring up in a nasty and new form. But you were talking about vacuity on policies. What about on growth? We know that growth is the priority. But we didn't hear many in the way of policies particularly there, did we?
The weakest part of the speech for me was the passage where he said, you know, and I know some of you are asking questions about my plan and whether it works. And he thought, yes, that is exactly the question that everyone's asking. And then he sort of skipped over the answer, which kind of best summarises, well, it's all going to work, just wait and see. And you thought, I think I need a little bit more than that to go on. There was nothing in that speech that looked like a new plan for growth. And some might say, well, fair enough, that's what the pre-budget statement this autumn is for. You wouldn't expect him necessarily to announce all of that now. But I think it still very much felt like a question hanging in the air. And I think as to whether Cameron is secure between now and 2015, I think that depends not on the speech, but on what comes after. Too often leaders tend to think, I made a big speech, tick that box, done. And actually what you then have to do is live that speech for the next 6 months. You have to show that it wasn't just some old cobblers you kind of put together for conference, but that it is part of a worked out, coherent, structured plan in which you then roll out ideas that show what you meant. And that's the bit that I'm not sure is coming next, frankly.
And what about Osborne? The one new policy I spotted there was this business about, I can't remember because so much had been briefed before, but shares, get shares in your company.
Your rights for shares.
Yeah, what do you think of that, Gabby?
Yes, I mean, I think the idea that that is some kind of mechanism for growth or massive, you know, new recruitment is just for the birds, really. I can see it being very appealing if you are coming into a new startup at director level, senior level in the company. You're not that bothered. You're a kind of 45-year-old man. You're never going to take flexible working. You're not going to get pregnant. You're not that bothered about being fired because you've got a cushion of savings. And to you, that just means, well, hey, you basically get a joining bonus of £50,000 worth of shares tax-free. Who wouldn't want that? But that is quite a small group of people who would have been hired anyway. I think most people coming into a company are not going to think, great, I'll just sign away all my rights in return for £2,000 worth of shares, which might be worth nothing in 2 years' time. I mean, I feel to a certain extent conflicted about this because I'm a freelance. I left a job which had proper employment rights, and I traded that for the freedom of working for who I wanted to, doing what I wanted to, and doing it when and where I wanted to. And for me, that was a worthwhile trade. But I accept that for an awful, you know, it's a very small minority of people who want to live with that level of risk.
That's right. I mean, it just it seemed to me, and they said in the briefing, you know, it's only for small startups. It doesn't feel like a strategy or any, or at least, Martin, if George Osborne does have a strategy, it feels like exactly the same strategy that he was using 3 years ago. He's still talking about 5 years into the future, but we've already had 3 years.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that, I mean, that's why I think all this comes together all the time around economic performance and growth and whether there is going to be anything in the autumn statement or the budget which can be presented as progress for the government. And, you know, the way it looks at the moment, that's not looking great. And that I think, is the nub of the whole thing, both economically and politically for the government. And if David Cameron, you know, is in the same position in the spring that he is in now, I mean, I just think that he's going to look across at number 11 and think, you know, is there some trick I can pull? You know, I've got an unpopular chancellor who is not succeeding with the economy. I just think that there's going to be a temptation to do something reckless there. I mean, because he doesn't do reckless, he probably won't do it. But I think that question is going to be much debated.
And Andrew, can we just close this section by asking you two questions very quickly? First of all, as a sort of more conservative voice, do you think that Ed Miliband's speech is just as empty as the speech we've been talking about on the conservative side this week?
No, I love Disraeli, and I love anyone who tries to cling to Disraeli's coattails. I thought it was a brilliant idea, and we'll have to see whether he manages to stick to it.
And secondly, we've said that, you know, David Cameron's bit of a drift position at the moment, and everything depends on the economy turning around. If Boris were in charge, what do you think he'd be doing different?
Well, he'd take more risks. He'd go for tax cuts. He'd go for building an airport on some mud flats somewhere downriver of London.
Just do things.
And in Europe, he would fight a war of movement if and when, which may be the case that there is some, there are very dramatic developments where it's no good just sort of sitting tight, or at least you actually have to try to go out and get things. He's not a sort of Enoch Powell figure, but he is a great deal more daring than Cameron. So it would be, as one Tory backbencher said to me, it would be a white knuckle ride, but it'd be a hell of a lot more fun, perhaps.
Well, no doubt we'll all continue to enjoy speculating. Now, with David Cameron due to meet Alex Salmond next week ahead of the SNP conference in Perth, details are emerging about a possible deal surrounding the referendum on Scottish independence. In returning for granting a simple in-out referendum, Alex Salmond wants votes for 16 and 17-year-olds. Martin, good idea?
Well, Salmond thinks that by expanding the electorate to include young people, even younger people than can vote already, he's somehow going to catch the mood of the nation in 2014. I almost said 13-14 when the referendum takes place. I don't think there's much evidence that that's going to happen. Young people don't vote on the whole. There might be some quite lively stuff goes on, and I'm sure the SNP, which is the best campaigning party in this country, and by this country I mean the United Kingdom, I mean they are a formidable campaigning organisation, very well organised. I'm sure they will do lots of things with a lot of young people and try to create a sense of, you know, a new generation and a new nation and all that sort of thing. I'm almost writing the script for them now, but it's not going to happen because, as a poll this week said, in the Glasgow Herald, support for independence currently at 28%, and no matter how many 16 and 17 year olds turn out to vote in 2014, if that stays the same or something more or less the same overall, then they're not going to make the difference.
It is interesting, isn't it, how in each of the conferences, particularly the Miliband speech and the Cameron speech, there was quite a big passage dedicated to holding the union together. And with the Tories in particular, Andrew, there'd be a good low politics argument for saying let Scotland go its own way. But they really are still the Conservative and Unionist Party.
I think Cameron is, actually. I think he does not wish to go down in history as the man who presided over the dissolution of the United Kingdom. So I think he will do what he can, and he knows he's got to be... I mean, the difficulty for him is that Alex Salmond is concentrating on this all the time. He concentrates on it only from time to time. And it is very, very easy for... I mean, obviously, Thatcher was the extreme example to do things in as a Tory Prime Minister in London, which utterly infuriate the Scots. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if he allows this 16-year-old voting. But then I think the 16-year-olds might surprise Salmond that 16-year-olds can be disconcertingly conservative on occasions. I don't mean with a small c rather than a... I don't mean they're actually going to vote Tory or anything, but they won't necessarily vote what Alex Salmond tells them is the trendy thing for 16-year-olds to do.
I mean, according to Ben Page of Moray on the radio this week, it's the 25 to 34s, the people who went to see Braveheart when it came out in 1990s, who are the most in favour of independence.
Very good.
But they're...
So it's Mel Gibson holds the key to this one.
Okay.
As I get older, I'm changing my mind more and more. And I used to think that, you know, if the under-25s don't even bother voting, then what on earth is the point of expanding the pool of non-voters? You know, you have to earn the right to vote. But I did a fringe on this, a sort of fringe on youth vote at conference last week as the token elderly person peering over my monocle. And actually... I have to say, there is something weird about the idea of no taxation without representation. You know, you can pay taxes at 16, but you don't have any say in how it's spent. And there's also just a little echo when people say, oh, 16-year-olds aren't bothered anyway, so don't give it to them, that reminds me of the way that people used to talk about kind of women's suffrage a century ago, you know, that nice women didn't really want to be bothered with all this anyway.
Would you go further?
There's only some kind of weirdo freaks who would ever be interested. And lo and behold, it turned out that women did want the vote, and particularly when politics evolved to actually have something to say to them. I think the nature of politics would change if under-18s voted as well.
Aren't we going the other way? I mean, we're about to stick up the school leaving age, or the education equivalent school leaving age, whatever it's called, to include vocational courses too, to 18. So it doesn't feel like it's one of those things where the tide of history is putting more responsibility on...
Except there's such a hodgepodge of things that you can and can't do between 16 and 18. We're completely confused about where adulthood kind of starts and ends. There's so many things that you can do at 16 and only a very few things that you have to wait till 18 for.
I suppose it's also possible, I mean, at the moment, I think about 80% of pensioners or something might vote, 40-odd percent of that order of people in the 18 to 24, and presumably the lower end of that for people who are 18. Yeah. But just maybe the rising generation might be more politicised, because it can vary, can't it? Between cohorts.
There's an argument that says if we're all so convinced they don't vote, well, why not try it in Scottish referendum and see what actually happens? And if it turns out that, you know, turnout among 16-year-olds is vanishingly low, well, fair enough. There's no point in proceeding with this.
We've called their bluff.
But if it turns out that it's high.
Martin?
I think it's worth remembering that when... I'm old enough to remember when the vote was lowered from 21 to 18. In fact, I first voted in the first election, which was 1970, which was the first election in which 18-year-olds had the vote, and lo and behold, it elected a Tory government. that's one consideration. I think lowering the vote from 21 to 18 probably had much more has had more effect than electorally than lowering the vote from 18 to 16 will do. Why? Because on the whole, the 16 and 17 year olds live at home or close to their parents, so they basically
the 25 year olds.
Yeah, but the 18 to 21s are at university, and they've created what we didn't used to have, which was student based university constituencies. I mean, that was less true in the 70s because there were fewer people at university, but now there's so many people at university between 18 and 21. You do have this pocket, this little group of constituencies. I mean, Cambridge is one.
But Norwich,
Leeds Northwest, Cardiff Central, those kind of seats, which are very student-based. And there's about a dozen to 20 of them. And, you know, they elect Liberal Democrats when Labour goes to war, and they'll probably elect Labour when...
Lib Dems put up fees.
So, you know, they march to their own different drum, I think. But I don't think there's an equivalent for 16 and 17-year-olds because they don't live in clustered places.
While we're on this referendum, and just before we close, can we just have a final thought on, is it all going to happen? Gabby, do you say, there's not going to be some brilliant Alex Salmon manoeuvre at the last minute to mean that the whole show gets pulled off, is there, if he decides?
I would not push it past Alex Salmon. If there's anyone more wily than Boris, it must be Alex Salmon. I would not put it past him to find some brilliant way to scuffle the whole thing and then blame it all on the, you know, the Westminster government. But it does feel as if, you know, we're moving inexorably in that direction. It has to be settled once and for all. So whether or not there's some sort of magic reason why it can't happen in 2014, I don't know. But I think we're moving there in the next 5 years, whatever happens.
Would Boris let it happen if he was going to lose, if he was Alex Salmond, Gandry?
Oh, that's incredibly imponderable what Boris would do. Listening to Martin just now, I wonder whether maybe we should put the voting age back up to 21.
I think that Alex Salmond, if I can just say on this, I think there will be a referendum. I think it will be defeated, but I think Alex Salmond's guilty secret is that he's not really imagining himself as the leader of an independent Scotland, but going on being the leader of a devolved Scotland after the independence referendum. So in many ways,
more devolved Scotland probably.
So he's looking at the 2016 election. So I think it's all going to go quite well for Alex Salmond as long as he's with us.
Well, there we are. Thanks very much indeed to Martin, to Gabby and to Andrew. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's KOBO.com, and at checkout put in the discount code MAFIASTATE for your Guardian podcast offer.